Hello and welcome to A Good Science Read. I'm Professor Frances Ashcroft and my guest today is Georgina Ferry. Georgina is a science writer, biographer and broadcaster. She has a particular interest in women in science, and her biography of the Nobel Prize-winning crystallographer Dorothy Hodgkin was shortlisted for both the Duff Cooper Prize and the March Biography Award. It has recently been reissued by Bloomsbury. Her next book, The Penicillin Century, will be published by Oxford University Press in 2028. Georgina, welcome to A Good Science Read.
I'm very happy to be here, Fran.
Today we're going to discuss two books about pandemics and infectious disease. Both, to me, read like thrillers and are really rather alarming. The first is The Coming Plague by Laurie Garrett, which provides a history of old and new plagues such as TB, influenza, Ebola, AIDS and hantavirus, and also tells the stories of the scientists who studied them. It's an extremely well-researched book, I believe, of over 700 pages, so quite large. Garrett also delivers an extremely severe warning about how ill-prepared we are to cope with emerging infectious disease and how politics, bureaucratic infighting and drug company competition makes things worse. Written over 30 years ago, she was remarkably prescient, as the COVID-19 pandemic has clearly shown. Why did you choose this book, Georgina?
Well, I mean, to declare an interest, as you mentioned, I'm writing a book myself to mark the centenary of the discovery of antibiotics by Alexander Fleming in 1928. And of course, so the centenary will be in 2028. And really, that story is a story of hubris, in a way, of how humanity thought, really from the end of the 19th century, that having discovered that germs cause disease, all we need to do is bash them over the head and everything will be fine. Even Fleming knew in his Nobel lecture was that microbes are extremely clever and you can find a drug that will kill them, like penicillin, but they will evolve a way around that. And what Laurie Garrett did so effectively, I think, in her book. And, as you say, this was 30 years ago, and we're still having the same conversations. But what she did was show that you can't just treat it like a kind of whack-a-mole where a new infection emerges and clever scientists invent a way of dealing with it and it's gone. That doesn't happen because the microbes will keep evolving. And they have been here, you know, they had the earth to themselves for 2.5 to 3 billion years before we even came along. And they spent that time evolving in intriguing ways of competing with each other, essentially, to make sure they always had the resources that they needed. They've got this arsenal of weapons, as have other microbes all microbes, whether we're talking about bacteria or yeasts or viruses, they all have ways of holding their place in whatever niche they choose to occupy. And they can occupy any niche, including us. When we came along, great, new place to live. So we've got them all living in our guts. And what I think the overall message of Laurie Garrett's book was that you've got to take into account the ecology of the microbial world before you can even start to think about how we're going to defend ourselves against disease.
She actually has a wonderful comment. She says that humans are walking petri dishes and, you know, they're ideal conditions for mutation selection and evolution. And because one of our problems is that people take antibiotics indiscriminately and they very often don't finish the course, or they take them when actually they don't have a bacteria at all as an infection. They actually have a virus or something like this. And they do fight back.
They always will. And I, one thing I picked up, and it was very pertinent to me, actually, because she quotes Bernard Dixon, who was the former, he sadly died now, but he was the former editor of New Scientist magazine. And he gave me my first job in science writing in 1979. But he was a microbiologist by training and did a lot of publicising of things like the use of antibiotics in agriculture, which has hugely exacerbated the problem because people in the agriculture industry uses antibiotics not just to damp down infection when animals are kept in hugely overcrowded conditions, but to promote growth. It was discovered that if you just feed antibiotics to farm animals, they grow faster. And they thought, oh, great. But it meant that resistant microbes evolved and transferred to individuals. But she quotes Bernard as saying, microbes, not macrobes, rule the world. And that's really stuck in my mind.
I think the other thing which I found fascinating is, you know, it's not, we have been very, we've been very off guard for many, many years. And one of the things which we sort of thought we had conquered was TB, tuberculosis. We have vaccinations against that, which actually I discover are not terribly effective against the lung disease. And she has this extraordinary comment. She says that in 1991, with the world facing a new TB crisis, this was due to TB being manifest for, again, amongst people who were drug users and things like this. It was suddenly noted that the global supply of streptomycin was tapped out. The second oldest antibiotic in commercial use was no longer manufactured by any company, and that's what was always used to treat TB. And because it's an unpatented and a cheap drug, really needed primarily at that time in developing countries, there was no significant profit for the potential manufacturers, so they just stopped making it.
That brings up another of her major points, which is that public health and human rights can't be distinguished from one another, and that you have to have a global approach that recognises that supporting the health of people in resource-poor countries is essential to preventing the spread of new infections and preventing the spread of things like TB. And of course, one of the major factors, you talked about drug users, but actually HIV, the advent of HIV depressed the immune systems of people who were then much more susceptible to TB, which is quite a slow growing bacterium and a lot of people have immunity to it. But if your immune system's depressed, then TB can take hold and flourish, which indeed it did.
Yes, and she highlights that very effectively, I think, all the prejudice and the lack of concern about particular groups of people. In fact, I think there was a comment from the editor of Nature, which was really surprising, which was about AIDS. And he said, mercifully, the disease, whatever the causation, is neither especially infectious nor certain in its effects. And he sort of dismissed it as something which just belonged or just manifest in gay men. And it seems extraordinary to me. And the other thing I thought was fascinating about the AIDS epidemic was that she pointed out that another problem which we see a lot, which is that the scientists were fighting against one another. So, for example, the people who were working in America thought that the disease was transmitted primarily by homosexual intercourse. But in Africa, it was a completely different picture because there it was heterosexually transmitted. And when scientists tried to publish this, they couldn't get their papers published. They were turned down all the time because peer review said, basically, we don't believe this. It's such a problem.
Yes, yes. I mean, she does try to look forward in a more optimistic way. I mean, she spells out very clearly what needs to be done and to a certain extent what has been done in terms of surveillance, and that has to be globally coordinated and indeed methods of globally coordinating disease surveillance have been set up and have been funded. I mean, often spearheaded by Western organisations like the Centres for Disease Control in the US or the Wellcome Trust in the UK, and they have a number of international centres across the developing world to collect information about new emerging infections. But that all seems positive, but, and she's acknowledges this big but, it depends on wars not breaking out in those countries, and it absolutely depends on the generosity of the wealthier countries in continuing to support these efforts, because they all need money. The countries they're in mostly don't have their own money. And it's terribly short-sighted to see, as we are seeing in the world at the moment, for rich countries to say, that's nothing to do with us, we're going to cut off funding to that, when actually we are all in this together. And if we don't tackle it as a united nations, it's going to come back and bite us.
That's what we heard in the COVID pandemic, I presume. I mean, you know, no one is safe until we are all safe.
Absolutely.
And it's so very true. I think another thing which we haven't said, which comes across in this book brilliantly, is the sort of the stories of the scientists involved and how incredible they were to just immediately fly into a danger area where you have a new disease emerging. And one of the problems about emerging diseases is at the start of an epidemic, there's so many unknowns. You don't know what's causing it. You don't know how it's spread. You don't know how infectious it is. You don't know the case fatality. You don't know if asymptomatic people are actually infectious. And you have no idea what the incidence in the population is because you haven't got a test. And indeed, it seems that many of these diseases have been circulating for some time, but just not recognised. And then suddenly something causes it to flare up, probably because people are living in much closer, two things, much closer with animals, wild animals, and much closer with each other.
Which brings us back to the ecological point, that it's all to do with how we live and how we share the world with both large animals and the microbial community.
Yes, so many of them seem to come from eating bushmeat, which again, of course, is a problem because if people are starving, that's what they're going to eat. But of course, the blood in these animals, very often then they get that on themselves and they pick up a new disease to which they're not resistant.
But another disease, and it wasn't to do with eating it, that she writes about, that must have only just, I think it was fairly newly discovered when she published the book in 1994, is hantavirus, which has been in the news recently because Gene Hackman's wife, Betsy Arakawa, very sadly, appears to have died. The couple were discovered, elderly couple discovered dead in their home in New Mexico. Was it New Mexico or Arizona? But anyway, somewhere.
One of them.
Somewhere around there. And it turns out that this disease, it's quite rare, but it's carried by rodents, particularly mice. And their remote home, although the home was fairly clean, the outbuildings were full of mice. And it looks as if she must have picked up the virus from one of these mice. But the reason she puts it sort of relatively late in her book is that when that disease was first discovered, all the things you talk about, finding out how it's transmitted, its genetic composition, all that kind of thing, was able to be done really quickly because all the scientific techniques were in place to make all those discoveries and to develop a test and to develop a vaccine so that hantavirus shouldn't continue to be a problem as long as people get themselves to some kind of healthcare reasonably quickly.
Mm. Yes, I think it's in the airborne particles, isn't it, that, you know, from dried rodent droppings,
things
like
yes,
this,
yes.
That you pick it up. Of course, the thing to look out for is to look out for, in you know, an explosion of deer mice. But there was a problem with that disease too, wasn't there? Because it first became apparent that it was in the Navajo population. And then people started to call it the Navajo disease in the same way that I'm afraid Trump, when he was president previously, used to call it the Wuhan disease or the Chinese flu. Or it doesn't help because, of course, it was, you know, anybody could be infected, as we have seen. I think there are some other things which she mentions about things that help transmission of viruses, particularly viruses, I think, the sort of reuse of syringes, which you may think is only occurring amongst, you know, drug users. But in fact, actually, in many cases, this was happening in Africa where they didn't have enough money to have syringes. So they were trying to sterilise them in very inadequate conditions. But they needed them to give vaccinations to children and so on. And so by doing so, they were actually infecting people. It's a terribly tragic story for some of these things. I think the other thing we should mention is the extraordinary danger that sometimes scientists put themselves in to identify the source of an outbreak, how they fly into the danger area. And One of the things I learnt, which I thought was fascinating, was that, of course, everybody's very afraid if you have some new virus like Ebola or Marburg. And when one of the scientists, a Western scientist, gets it, then they want to be flown out to be taken care of in their hospital in their home country. But how do you get them there? And one of the things they did, if you remember, was they used the Apollo space capsule because it was actually, you know, it was a sealed vessel and it had a filtered air supply. And I just thought that is so extraordinary.
Yes, and I think she really brings out the distinction between those scientists who fly into these danger zones. I mean, she mentions a chap called Jim McCormick quite often, who worked for the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, having as a very young man gone to Zaire as a teacher and become inspired to train as a tropical medicine and infectious diseases specialist, and spent a lot of his time subsequently flying out to some of these very dangerous areas, but working from the CDC. But eventually he left because he was so disillusioned with the bureaucracy and the pen pushers who, as he saw it, really failed to understand what the situation was on the ground and how that needed to be dealt with. Yet she brings us back all the time to how you need to have buy-in from the political leaders in order to achieve success against infectious disease.
And we're going to see a lot more about that in the next book, which we'll come to in a minute. But I just wanted to mention that it would be very nice if she were to write a new version of this, an update, because since the book was written, there have been numerous new diseases come along. I mean, SARS, MERS, Zika, COVID-19, BSE, all of these things, chikungunya. It's fascinating. So it's happening all the time, and that's just in 30 years.
But she looks forward to that, doesn't she?
Just she does.
In her very title, the book is called The Coming Plague. I mean, what she's saying is we've had all these, we've reacted to them in all these ways, but it's not the end of the story. There will be more.
And I love what she says at the very end of the book. She says, all new diseases must be noticed by someone who has the insight and courage to sound an alarm and set it in motion. And once in place, investigations are best conducted in an atmosphere of candour and collectivity, rather than the secrecy, backbiting, rivalry and mutual contempt that has unfortunately characterised many other scientific pursuits of emerging microbes.
Well, I've got a favourite quote, and I'll just say this one quickly before we move on to the next book. She says, ultimately, humanity will have to change its perspective on its place in Earth's ecology if the species hopes to stave off or survive the next plague.
Yes, and we haven't finished, have we, with the plagues?
Absolutely not.
So let's move on to the next book, which is about a different plague. The book, which is my choice, is Spike, the Virus Versus the People. And this is an account of the COVID-19 pandemic written by Jeremy Farrar and Anjana Ahuja. Farrar is an expert on infectious disease, and he was at the very heart of the fight against the virus. And Ahuja is a science writer for the Financial Times. That probably helps to explain why the book is so very well written. The book tells of Farrar's initial concerns that the virus could have been manufactured, explains why there are so many variants, and considers what we should have done differently. But for me, I think the most interesting thing is his brilliant description of the disputes between the UK scientists and the politicians on how to contain the virus. It was published in July 2021 while the pandemic was still ongoing and the world was in turmoil. And it was shortlisted for the Orwell Prize and the Royal Society Book Prize. What did you think of the book?
Well, you slightly stole my thunder right at the beginning by saying both books read like thrillers, but this one really reads like a thriller. And what you the difference, I think, between this and Laurie Garrett's book, I mean, as you say, her book is fantastically well researched, but this is a personal account right from the middle of what was going on while it was going on. And Jeremy Farrar has this extraordinary quality. I was trying to think whether there was an example of a character in fiction like this, and I couldn't find one. It's not Zelig. But whenever anything important was happening or any important decision was being taken, he seemed to be there, if not actually driving it. And so one of the key messages I took away from this book really was the importance of individuals putting themselves on the line, saying this is important, both as individuals, but also immediately phoning, you get a huge sense of his incredible network of specialists across the globe whom he can pick up the phone to and they will answer his call. And between them say, look, governments are not moving on this. We have to do something. We have to get this information out. And then, yeah, as you say, the frustration of collecting all that data, sitting through the meetings of SAGE, the Scientific Advisory Committee for Emergencies, which tried to pull all this information together in order to advise the government on its policy, and then seeing policies announced that actually didn't entirely match what SAGE was saying.
Not at all.
And this happening over and over again. But it's the personal passion behind the writing that I think really comes over.
He does make the point, actually, that even he didn't realise how much was done by just people talking on WhatsApp or picking up the phone. But it seems that all major decisions are done that way.
Mm. But also the other thing I think is interesting and links back to Laurie Garrett's work is that, you know, she talks about how gradually as epidemic after epidemic came, these various collaborative networks were set up. And so that it was one of these, I've got a note of the name of it. It was an online e-list at which he first read about the existence of this
yes.
strange new pneumonia in China. But anyway, it was, as I say, an e-list for any doctor anywhere just to stick up a note and say, I've seen this weird thing. And it was obviously something that Jeremy had his eyes across all the time, and he spotted this, made a call to a very senior epidemiologist in China and said, what's going on? And from that moment, he was engaged.
Yes, and it was good that he picked up that particular message, because if you look on that website, you will see that there are dozens of these things posted every day. And some of them will turn out to be nothing, and some of them have the potential to be a plague. And he just felt this one smelt wrongly. And
it's partly because it seemed to link to SARS, and he'd been quite involved with SARS because he was working in Southeast Asia at the time.
I think it's also where it was, because Wuhan not only had a lot of people working on viruses because it had the Wuhan Center for Disease Control, but it also had P3 laboratories or whatever. It also had a wet market from which we know things can emerge, new diseases can emerge. What I found completely fascinating was the fact that he takes you through the time course of the pandemic. So you start at the beginning and then you move towards the end. So, and basically what you do when you're having lived through it, and having kept a diary of it, I kept looking at my diary to compare with what he was doing at the same time. And it was quite interesting because I also picked up on this early, even though I'm not an infectious disease specialist. But as early as, when was this? Very early on in January, I have a note in my diary that says, Where are the face masks I bought after the last swine flu pandemic, which had been sitting in a box for 10 years?
Very prescient of you.
I don't know why we came to have them, but we did.
Mm.
And then when we tried to order some later, of course, it was totally unsuccessful because they were all taken by the NHS, quite rightly. But it's also interesting because I think that, just as we discussed already, I suspect that was circulating much earlier in China than before it was actually posted on the website, because you would only get something posted on the website when the individual had actually seen a doctor. And if they were younger and had a less severe form of the disease, they just think it was flu.
He does mention in the book that Chinese scientists had actually got the sequence
yes.
in December.
Mm.
And it was New Year's Eve when he read this note. So it wasn't just that it was circulating, but it was actually on the radar of Chinese scientists before even Jeremy got to hear about it. He does talk about those first few weeks, it being pretty obvious that the Chinese authorities were trying to suppress the information. And it was really people like him and his colleagues who were sharing, and including Chinese colleagues,
yes,
who were sharing information, who eventually forced it out into the open.
Yes, and of course, one of the things he started to be concerned about, which is where this book turns into something like a spy thriller, is when he suddenly wonders whether, in fact, the virus might have been engineered and might have either escaped from a laboratory in Wuhan or been deliberately released. And as he describes how he goes and gets a burner phone, and he was completely nervous about his own personal safety. And it's that's actually quite interesting.
I think it would make a terrific movie, don't you?
Oh, yes. Do you think his anxiety was reasonable?
Yes. I do. I can see why he felt the way that he did. We know that powerful states have long arms and subtle ways of dealing with information that they don't want to get out. And it's also partly that if he was wrong about anything and it got out, I mean, I think there were reasons careful.
I think the thing is, one always wants to know where a new infectious disease comes from so that you can prevent it later, and also so you can understand something more about the way it transmits. And one of the things which he was particularly concerned about was that it was highly infectious. It had mutations in the receptor binding domain that were optimised for binding to the human receptor.
As he said, I mean, this was one of the arguments for the lab leak theory, that it looked designed to infect humans.
And it also had this furin cleavage site, which is a little bit of DNA that's seen in highly infectious viruses, but had not previously been found in coronaviruses. However, we now know, by at least from a lot of work done by many people, that this is very unlikely to have been anything other than a native infection.
And an escape from possibly a bat or a civet cat or a
raccoon,
wild animal. Mm. But again, because of people living in very close proximity with animals and people living in very crowded conditions.
But I think it's still a controversy. It's a highly political issue at the moment because people want to have somebody to blame. And now, just in December 2024, the US Republicans concluded that it's a lab leak, whereas the Democrats and the scientists are saying, no, this is highly, highly unlikely. So that's one failure in government response, but I think there are many more, aren't there? I mean, particularly, the book really focuses on what happens in UK government. It doesn't claim to be explaining what's happening in the USA or Singapore or somewhere. But he makes the point quite strongly that the scientists advise, they don't make policy. It's up to the politicians to make policy. But they really need to understand what the scientists are saying, and they very often just don't listen.
Until they get something like Neil Ferguson of Sage coming up, because there was this... I distinctly remember hearing about that, listening to interviews about this on The World at One at the time, this idea that herd immunity would solve the problem, and that if you just let, as long as you protected people who were immunocompromised or elderly, you just let the thing rip through the population and everybody will become immune, or 60 or 80% of people will become immune, and after that the epidemic will die away. And there are theoretical reasons for thinking that might happen, but as it turned out, not with this particular virus. But the idea that you might do that was modelled by Neil Ferguson at Imperial College, and he came up with this figure of 400,000 deaths. And it wasn't really till he said 400,000 people could die that the policymakers really paid attention and thought, oh, well, perhaps we better have a lockdown.
Well, yes. I mean, Boris was saying that we should just take it on the chin, wasn't he?
Yes,
that was,
yes, that was
the phrase I remember. He was really against lockdown. And Farrow is pretty scathing about Boris's handling of the pandemic, and says that people actually died unnecessarily because of political decisions, and lockdown should have been taken substantially earlier. And Cummings also said the same sort of thing, Dominic Cummings, in his address. He says here, the PM spent most of February dealing with a combination of divorce, his current girlfriend wanting to make announcements about their relationship, an ex-girlfriend running around in the media, financial problems exacerbated by his flat renovation, and other nonsense, because he never clearly took the whole thing seriously. That's very damning, isn't it?
From Cummings, yes, who was the architect of his rise in many ways. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. But then, of course, what happens is the pandemic became on a runaway trajectory, and we got basically the exponential spike in cases, which I think actually one of the things I admire is the choice of title for the book and also the book cover, because it shows the exponential increase in virus particles and infections. And the spike, of course, is not just the spike protein, which is used by the virus to infect the person, but also the spike in cases which follows.
It's very clever, yeah.
It's extremely clever. Mm. I don't know what you think, but I think that in popular science books, the title and the cover are extremely important. They're what make people pull it off the shelf and look inside.
Absolutely, yes, yes. And again, I mean, you said we need a sequel to The Coming Plague. We need a sequel to Spike, really, because it does finish in the middle of things, really. It was still in the middle of things in July 2021.
Yes, he has quite a lot of, at the end, where he talks about protecting the world and how we need to get vaccines away from countries which are hoarding them and give them to the countries which don't need them. One of the things that's really interesting is that Africa didn't really, I mean, not as many people died as had been predicted. And I think perhaps one of the reasons they weren't so devastated is that they have a younger population.
Yes.
And they spent more time outside because of the climate being different. And they don't have so many comorbidities. And maybe lesser testing meant that the population was underestimated who had the disease. So, yes, well, he finishes the book with a list of dramatis personae. Did you find that useful?
Yes, because he does talk about a lot of people, and he tends to just refer to them by first names because they're all his mates. Yes. At least a lot of them are. So yes, to review who was involved was certainly a useful thing to have.
I was rather surprised that there was almost no mention of any of the people who were involved in creating the vaccines.
Oh, there's another name. I don't think we should mention it. I don't know if we should mention names. There's another name of somebody who, if you talk to him, and I have, was clearly central to an awful lot of the policy planning that went on. He's not mentioned at all in the book.
I suppose it's just the people who he knows or the people who he's friends with. So I think there are things which are somewhat lacking.
It must have been done in haste.
Of course.
So it does shows signs of haste. It's a sort of classic essay comment. But that's part of its...
That's part of its appeal.
Its thrilling nature, part of its appeal, yes. Yes.
And actually there's quite a lot of direct emails which are just reproduced exactly, I think, as he sent them.
Well, they must have been the source material, I think, unless he keeps it. I don't know if you know whether he doesn't mention having kept a diary, but he probably gave Anjana access to his emails.
Yes.
I mean, obviously with some censorship, but they would, between them, have reconstructed events through his email contacts, I'm quite sure. And quoting them directly is something I approve of. I love direct quotes because it just gives you a sense of the urgency of the time.
Yes. It's very immediate, isn't it? Actually, you have collated a wonderful set of oral histories from a very diverse group of people working on the front line in Oxford during the COVID-19 pandemic. Did you learn a lot more from them than perhaps you did from this book? Because you did that later, I believe.
Oh, yes. I didn't start doing that until, let me think, because I went on over 2 years in the end. I think I started towards the end of 2021 and went on well into 2023, because I did 50 and then they came back and said, we've got funding for you to do another 50. It was a Bodleian project. Bodleian jointly with the History of Science Museum. And they did a project called Collecting COVID. So the oral histories were just a part of that. They also collected documents and objects that had to do with Oxford's response to the pandemic. So that, yes, the key was people who had been doing something else, but when COVID came along, switched their research to focus on COVID. And I was given pretty much carte blanche to go and talk to whoever I wanted, with the also part of the brief that I shouldn't just talk to the big cheeses. I did talk to quite a lot of big cheeses, but I also talked to graduate students, nurses, administrators, people who'd been involved at every level of the organisation. So, and I did 100 interviews, Fran, and most of them were at least an hour long. So, yes, I learnt more than I did from Jeremy's book, but it was a different perspective. And most of these people were not at the centre of planning and coordinating the whole thing. It was very much a focus on what was happening here in Oxford. I mean, some of them were, you know, people like Martin Landrei and Peter Hawpey, who Jeremy
feature?
Also mentions, because they set up the recovery trial, which was one of the great successes of the COVID era, because it showed what drugs could help if you had COVID and which ones couldn't. Terribly important piece of work to have done.
Well, I think they're very fascinating. Even the ones which are from the graduate students are so interesting about how they had to change their lives. So I think that once one's read Spike, this is a very interesting thing to go on and look at listen to later.
That's very kind.
But I think we have to stop now, I'm afraid. We could go on forever, I think, with this. My thanks to my guest, Georgina Ferry. The books we have been discussing are The Coming Plague by Laurie Garrett, published in 1995 by Virago Press, and Spike, The Virus Versus the People by Jeremy Farrar and Anjana Ahuja, published by Profile Books in 2021. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the Oxford University website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.